A fine wooden cabinet was opened to reveal bottles and glasses, and the laws of Islam were violated. But Drine didn't mind. He had a glass of vodka, for which he'd acquired the taste 20 years earlier in Moscow, then the capital of a country now vanished. They were surprisingly quiet for such powerful men, all the more so for people attending the wake of a man they'd never loved. They sipped their drinks, mainly scotch, and again they mainly looked at one another. On the television, still switched on, the local station was replaying the funeral procession, the announcer extolling the surpassing virtue of the fallen leader. The generals looked on and listened, but the look on their faces was not one of sadness, but fear. Their world had come to an end. They were not moved by the shouts of the citizens or the words of the news commentator. They all knew better. The last of them arrived. He was the intelligence chief who'd met Bedrine earlier in the day, fresh from having stopped in at his headquarters. The others looked to him, and he answered without the necessity of hearing the question. "Everything is quiet, my friends. For now." That terse observation didn't have to be spoken, either. Bedrine could have spoken, but he didn't. His was an eloquent voice. Over the years he'd had to motivate many persons, and he knew how. But this was a time when silence was the most powerful statement of all. He merely looked at them and waited, knowing that his eyes spoke far more loudly than any voice could have done. "I don't like this," one of them said finally. Not a single face changed. Hardly surprising. None of them liked it. The one who spoke merely affirmed what all thought, and showed himself in doing so to be the weakest of the group. "How do we know we can trust your master?" the head of the guards asked. "He gives you his word in the name of God," Bedrine replied, setting down his glass. "If you wish, a delegation of your number may fly to see him. In that case, I will remain here as your hostage. But if you wish that, it must be done quickly." They all knew that, too. The thing they feared was as likely to happen before their possible departure as after. There followed another period of silence. They were scarcely even sipping at their drinks now. Bedrine could read their faces. They all wanted someone else to make a stand, and then that stand could be agreed to or disputed. And in the process, the group would reach a collective position with which all would probably abide, though there might be a faction of 2 or 3 to consider an alternative course of action. That depended on which of them placed his life on the scales and tried to weigh it against an unknown future. He waited vainly to see who would do that. Finally, one of them spoke. "I was late marrying," the Air Force chief said. His 20s and 30s had been the life of a fighter pilot, on the ground if not quite in the air. "I have young children." He paused and looked around. "I think we all know the possible, the likely outcome for our families, should things develop unfavorably." It was a dignified gambit, Bedrine thought. They could not be cowardly. They were soldiers, after all. Daryai's promise in God's name was not overly convincing to them. It had been a very long time since any of them had visited a mosque for any purpose other than to be photographed there in his simulated devotions. And though it was very different for their enemy, trust in another man's religion begins in one's own heart. "I presume that finances are not at issue here," Bedrine said, both to be sure that it was not, and to make them examine that option themselves. A few heads turned with looks that were close to amusement, and the question was answered. Though official Iraqi accounts had long been frozen, there were other such accounts which had not. The nationality of a bank account was, after all, fungible, all the more so with the size of the account. Each of these men, Bedrine thought, had personal access to 9 figures of some hard currency, probably dollars or pounds, and this was not the time to worry about whose money it should have been. The next question was, where could they go, and how could they get there safely? Badrine could see that in their faces, and yet he could do nothing at the moment. The irony of the situation, which only he was in a position to appreciate, was that the enemy whom they feared, and whose word they distrusted, wished nothing more than to allay their fear and keep his word. But Ali knew him to be a surpassingly patient man. Else he would not have been here at all.
"You're quite sure?"
"The situation is nearly ideal," Darya's visitor told him, explaining further. Even for a religious man who believed in the will of God, the confluence of events was just too good to be true, and yet it was, or appeared to be so.
"And?"
"And we are proceeding according to the plan."
"Excellent."
"It wasn't." Daryai would have much preferred to deal with each in turn, the better to concentrate his formidable intellect on the three developing situations one at a time. But this was not always possible, and perhaps that was the sign. In any case, he had no choice. How strange that he should feel trapped by events resulting from plans he himself had set in motion. The hardest part was dealing with his World Health Organization colleagues. That was only possible because the news was good so far. Benedict Makusa, the index patient or patient zero, depending on one's favored terminology, was dead, and his body was destroyed. A team of 15 had scoured the family's neighborhood and found nothing as yet. The critical period had yet to run out. Ebola Zaire had a normal incubation period of 4 to 10 days, though there were extreme cases as brief as 2 days and as long as 19. But the only other case was before his eyes. It turned out that Makusa was a budding naturalist, who spent much of his free time in the bush. And so now there was a search team in the tropical forest, catching rodents and bats and monkeys, to make yet another attempt to discover the host, or carrier of the deadly virus. But above all, they hoped that, for once, fortune had smiled on them. The index patient had come directly to hospital because of his family status. His parents, educated and affluent, had let healthcare professionals treat the boy instead of doing so themselves. And in that, they had probably saved their own lives, though even now they were waiting out the incubation period with what had to be stark terror that surpassed even their grief at the loss of a son. Every day they had their blood drawn for the standard IFA and antigen tests, but the tests could be misleading, as some insensitive medico had foolishly told them. Regardless, the WHO team was allowing itself to hope that this outbreak would stop at 2 patient victims, and because of that, they were willing to consider what Dr. Moudi proposed to do. There were objections, of course. The local Zairean physicians wanted to treat her here. There was merit to that. They had more experience with Ebola than anybody, though it had done little good to anyone. And the WHO team was reluctant for political reasons to insult their colleagues. There had been some unfortunate incidents before, with the natural hauteur of the Europeans resented by the local doctors. There was justice on both sides. The quality of the African doctors was uneven. Some were excellent, some terrible, and some ordinary. The telling argument was that Rousseau in Paris was a genuine hero to the international community, a gifted scientist and a ferociously dedicated clinician who refused to accept the fact that viral diseases could not be treated effectively. Rousseau, in the tradition of Pasteur before him, was determined to break that rule. He'd tried ribavirin and interferon as treatments for Ebola without positive result. His latest theoretical gambit was dramatic and likely to be ineffective, but it had shown some small promise in monkey studies, and he wanted to try it on a human patient under carefully controlled conditions. Though his proposed method of treatment was anything but practical for real clinical application, you had to start somewhere. The deciding factor, predictably, was the identity of the patient. Many of the WHO team knew her from the last Ebola outbreak at Kikwit. Sister Jean-Baptiste had flown to that town to supervise the local nurses, and doctors, no less than others, could be moved by familiarity with those under their care. Finally, it was agreed that, yes, Dr. Mahoudi could transport the patient. The mechanics of the transfer were difficult enough. They used a truck rather than an ambulance, because a truck would be easier to scrub down afterward. The patient was lifted on a plastic sheet onto a gurney and wheeled out into the corridor. That was cleared of other people, and as Mahoudi and Sister Maria Magdalena wheeled the patient toward the far door, a group of technicians dressed in plastic spacesuits sprayed the floor and walls, the very air itself, with disinfectant, in a smelly man-made chemical fog that trailed the procession like exhaust from an overaged car. The patient was heavily sedated and firmly restrained. Her body was cocooned to prevent the release of virus-rich bleeding. The plastic sheet under her had been sprayed with the same neutralizing chemicals so that leaks would immediately find a very adverse environment for the virus particles they carried. As Mahoudi pushed the gurney from behind, he marveled at his own madness, taking such chances with something as deadly as this. Jean-Baptiste's face, at least, was placid from the dangerously high dosage of narcotics, marked, though it was, with the growing petechia. They moved outdoors onto the loading dock, where supplies arrived at the hospital. The truck was there, its driver seated firmly behind the wheel, and not even looking backward at them, except perhaps in the mirror. The interior of the van body had likewise been sprayed, and with the door closed and the gurney firmly locked in place, it drove off with a police escort, never exceeding 30 kilometers per hour for the short trip to the local airport. That was just as well. The sun was still high, and its heat rapidly turned the truck into a mobile oven, boiling off the protective chemicals into the enclosed space. The smell of the disinfectant came through the suit's filtration system. Fortunately, the doctor was used to it. The aircraft was waiting. The G-4 had arrived only 2 hours earlier after a direct flight from Tehran. The interior had been stripped of everything but 2 seats and a cot. Mahoudi felt the truck stop and turn and back up. Then the cargo door opened, dazzling them with the sun. Still the nurse, and still a compassionate one, Sister Maria Magdalena used her hand to shield the eyes of her colleague. There were others there, of course. 2 more nuns in protective garb were close by, and a priest, with yet more farther away. All were praying as some others lifted the patient by the plastic sheet and carried her slowly aboard the white-painted business jet. It took 5 careful minutes before she was firmly strapped in place, and the ground crewman withdrew. Mahoudi gave his patient a careful look, checking pulse and blood pressure, the former rapid and the latter still dropping. That worried him. He needed her alive as long as possible. With that done, he waved to the flight crew and strapped into his own seat. Sitting down, he took the time to look out his window, and Mahoudi was alarmed to see a TV camera pointed at the aircraft. At least they kept their distance, the doctor thought, as he heard the first engine spool up. Out the other window, he saw the cleanup crew respraying the truck. That was overly theatrical. Ebola, deadly as it was, appeared to be a delicate organism, soon killed by the ultraviolet of direct sunlight, vulnerable also to heat. That was why the search for the host was so frustrating. Something carried this dreadful bug. Ebola could not exist on its own, but whatever it was that provided a comfortable home to the virus, whatever it was that Ebola rewarded for the service by not harming it, whatever the living creature was that haunted the African continent like a shadow, was as yet undiscovered. The physician grunted. Once he'd hoped to discover that host and so make use of it, but that hope had always been in vain. Instead, he had something almost as good. He had a living patient whose body was now breeding the pathogen, and while all previous victims of Ebola had been burned or buried in soil soaked with chemicals, this one would have a very different fate. The aircraft started moving. Maudi checked his seat belt again and wished he could have something to drink. Forward, the two pilots were wearing flight suits of protective Nomex previously sprayed. Their face masks muffled their words, forcing repetition of their request for clearance. But finally the tower got things right, and the Gulf Stream began its takeoff roll, rotating swiftly into the clean African sky and heading north. The first leg of their trip would be 2,551 miles, and would last just over 6 hours. Another, nearly identical G-4 had already landed at Benghazi, and now its crew was being briefed on emergency procedures.
"Cannibals!"
Holbrook shook his head in temporary disbelief. He'd slept very late, having been up late the night before, watching all manner of talking heads on C-SPAN discuss the confusing situation with Congress after this Ryan guy's speech. Not a bad speech, considering. He'd seen worse. All lies, of course, kind of like a TV show. Even the ones you liked, well, you just knew that they weren't real, funny though they might be in ways intended and not. Some talented man had written the speech with the purpose of getting just the right points across. The skill of those people was impressive. The mountain men had worked for years to develop a speech they could use to get people mobilized to their point of view. Tried and tried, but they just couldn't ever get it right. It wasn't that their beliefs had anything wrong with them, of course. They all knew that. The problem was packaging, and only the government and its ally, Hollywood, could afford the right people to develop the ideas that twisted the minds of the poor dumb bastards who didn't really get it. That was the only possible conclusion. But now there was discord in the enemy camp. Ernie Brown, who'd driven over to wake his friend up, muted the TV.
"I guess there just isn't enough room for both of them in that there town, Pete."
"You think one of them will be gone by sundown?" Holbrook asked.
"I wish."
The legal commentary they'd just watched on the CNN Political Hour had been as muddled as a nigger march on Washington to increase welfare.
"Well, gee, the Constitution doesn't say what to do in a case like this. I suppose they could settle it with 44s on Pennsylvania Avenue at sundown," Ernie added with a chuckle.
Pete turned his head and grinned.
"Wouldn't that be a sight? Too American."
Brown might have added that Ryan had actually been in a position like that once, or so the papers and TV said.
Well, yeah, it was true.
Both vaguely remembered the thing in London, and, truth be told, they'd both been proud to see an American showing the Europeans how a gun is used. Foreigners didn't know dick about guns, did they? They were as bad as Hollywood. It was a shame Ryan had gone bad. What he'd said in his speech, that was why he'd entered the government. That's what they all said. At least with that Keelty puke, he could fall back on family and stuff. They were all crooks and thieves, and that's just how the guy was brought up after all. At least he wasn't a hypocrite about it. A high-class gypsy or coyote? Yeah, that was right. Keelty was a lifetime political crook, and he was just being what he was. You couldn't blame a coyote from crooning at the moon. He was just being himself, too. Of course, coyotes were pests. Local ranchers could kill all they wanted. Brown tilted his head.
Pete?
Yeah, Ernie.
Holbrook reached for the TV controller and was about to unmute it.
"We got a constitutional crisis, right?"
It was Holbrook's turn to look.
"Yeah, that's what all the talking heads say.
And it just got worse, right?"
"The Keelty thing? Sure looks that way."
Pete set the controller down. Ernie was having another idea attack.
"What if,
Brown started and stopped, staring at the silent TV. It took time for his thoughts to form, Holbrook knew, though they were often worth waiting for. The 707 landed, finally, at Tehran Mehrabad International Airport, well after midnight. The crews were zombies, having flown almost continuously for the past 36 hours, well over the cautious limits of civil aviation, abused all the more by the nature of their cargo, and in so foul a mood from it all that angry words had been traded during the long descent. But the aircraft touched down with a heavy thump, and with that came relief and embarrassment, which each of the three felt as they took a collective sigh. The pilot shook his head and rubbed his face with a tired hand, taxiing south, steering between the blue lights. This airport is also the site of Iranian military and Air Force headquarters. The aircraft completed its turn, reversing directions and heading for the spacious Air Force ramp area. Though its markings were civil, the 707 actually belonged to the Iranian Air Force. Trucks were waiting there, the flight crew was glad to see. The aircraft stopped. The engineer switched off the engines. The pilot set the parking brakes. The three men turned inward.
"A long day, my friends," the pilot said by way of apology. "God willing, a long sleep to follow it," the engineer, he'd been the main target of his captain's temper, replied, accepting it.
They were all too weary to sustain an argument in any case, and after a proper rest, they wouldn't remember the reasons for it anyway. They removed their oxygen masks to be greeted by the thick, fetid smell of their cargo, and it was everything they could do not to vomit as the cargo door was opened in the rear. They couldn't leave just yet. The aircraft was well and truly stuffed with cages, and short of climbing out the windows, which was too undignified, they'd have to await their freedom, rather like passengers at any international terminal. Soldiers did the unloading, a process made all the more difficult by the fact that no one had warned their commander to issue gloves, as the Africans had done. Every cage had a wire handle at the top, but the African greens were every bit as testy as the men up front, clawing and scratching at the hands trying to lift them. Reactions differed among the soldiers. Some slapped at the cages, hoping to cow the monkeys into passivity. The smart ones removed their field jackets and used them as a buffer when they handled the cages. Soon a chain of men was established and the cages were transferred one at a time to a series of trucks. The procedure was noisy. It was barely 50 degrees in Tehran that night, far below what the monkeys were accustomed to, and that didn't help their collective mood any more than anything else that had happened to them over the past few days. They responded to the newest trauma with screeches and howls that echoed across the ramp. Even people who'd never heard monkeys before would not mistake it for anything else, but that could not be helped. Finally, it was done. The cabin door opened, and the crew had a chance to look at what had become of their once spotless aircraft. It would be weeks before they got the smell out, they were sure, and just scrubbing it down would be an onerous task best not considered at the moment. Together they walked aft, then down the stairs and off to where their cars were parked. The monkeys headed north in what for them was their third or fourth, and last, journey by truck. It was a short one, up a divided highway, over a cloverleaf interchange built under the reign of the Shah, then west to Hassanabad. Here there was a farm, long since set aside for the same purpose which had occasioned the transport of the monkeys from Africa to Asia. The farm was state-owned, used as an experimental station to test new crops and fertilizers, and it had been hoped that the produce grown here would feed the new arrivals. But it was still winter, and nothing was growing at the moment. Instead, several truckloads of dates from the southeastern region of the country had just arrived. The monkeys smelled them as their transport pulled up to the new three-story concrete building that would be their final home. It only agitated them all the more, since they'd had neither food nor water since leaving the continent of their birth. But at least it gave them the hope of a meal, and a tasty one at that, as a last meal is supposed to be. The Gulfstream G-4 touched down at Benghazi exactly on its flight plan. It had actually been as pleasant a journey as was possible under the circumstances. Even the normally roiled air over the central Sahara had been calm, making for a smooth ride. Sister Jean-Baptiste had remained unconscious for most of the flight, drifting into semi-awareness only a few times, and soon drifting back out again, actually more comfortable than the other four people aboard, whose protective garb prevented even a sip of water. The doors never opened on the aircraft. Instead, fuel trucks pulled up, and their drivers dismounted to attach hoses to the caps in the long white wings. Dr. Mahoudi was still tensely awake. Sister Maria Magdalena was dozing. She was as old as the patient and had scarcely slept in days, devoted as she was to her colleague. It was too bad, Mahoudi thought, frowning as he looked out the window. It was unjust. He didn't have it in his heart to hate these people any more. He'd felt that way once. He'd thought all Westerners were enemies of his country. But these two were not. Their home country was essentially neutral toward his. They were not the animistic pagans of Africa, ignorant and uncaring of the true God. They'd devoted their lives to service in his name, and both had surprised him by showing respect for his personal prayers and devotions. More than anything, he respected their belief that faith was a path to progress, rather than acceptance of preordained destiny, an idea not totally congruent with his Islamic beliefs, but not exactly contrary to them either. Maria Magdalena had a rosary in her hands, disinfected, which she used to organize her prayers to Mary, mother of Jesus the prophet, venerated as thoroughly in the Koran as in her own abbreviated scriptures, and as fine a model for women to follow as any woman who had ever lived. Mahoudi snapped his head away from them to look outside. He couldn't allow such thoughts. He had a task, and here were the instruments of that task, one's fate assigned by Allah, and the other's chosen by herself. And that was that. The task was without, not within. Not one of his making. A fact made clear when the fuel trucks pulled away and the engine started up again. The flight crew was in a hurry, and so was he, the better to get the troublesome part of his mission behind and the mechanical part begun. There was reason to rejoice. All those years among pagans, living in tropical heat, not a mosque within miles of his abode. Miserable, often tainted food, always wondering if it was clean or unclean, and never really being sure. That was behind him. What lay before was service to his God and his country. Two aircraft, not one, taxied off to the main north-south runway, jostling as they did so on concrete slabs made uneven by the murderous desert heat of summer and the surprising cold of winter nights. The first of them was not Mahoudi's. That G-4, outwardly identical in every way but a single digit's difference on the tail code, streaked down the runway and lifted off due north. His aircraft duplicated the takeoff roll, but as soon as the wheels were up, this G-4 turned right for a southeasterly heading toward Sudan, a lonely aircraft in a lonely desert night. The first turned slightly west and entered the normal international air corridor for the French coast. In due course, it would pass near the island of Malta, where a radar station existed to serve the needs of the airport at Valletta, and also to perform traffic control duties for the central Mediterranean. The crew of this aircraft were all Air Force types who customarily flew political and business luminaries from point to point, which was safe, well-paid, and boring. Tonight would be different. The co-pilot had his eyes fixed jointly on his knee chart and the GPS navigation system. 200 miles short of Malta, at a cruising altitude of 39,000 feet, he took the nod from the pilot and flipped the radar transponder setting to 7711. Valletta approach, Valletta approach, this is November Juliet Alpha, Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. The controller at Valeta immediately noted the triple bogey signature on his scope. It was a quiet watch at the traffic control center, the normally sparse air traffic to monitor, and this night was as routine as any other. He keyed his microphone at once as his other hand waved for his supervisor.
"Juliet Alpha, Valeta, are you declaring an emergency, sir?"
"Valeta, Juliet Alpha, affirmative. We are medical evacuation flight inbound Paris from Zaire. We just lost number two engine, and we have electrical problems. Stand by."
"Juliet Alpha, Valeta, standing by, sir."
The scope showed the aircraft's altitude as 390, then 380, then 370.
"Juliet Alpha, Valeta, I show you losing altitude."
The voice in his headphones changed.
"Mayday! Mayday! Mayday! Both engines out! Both engines out! Attempting restart. This is Juliet Alpha."
"Your direct penetration course, Valeta, is 343. Say again, direct vector Valeta, 343. We are standing by, sir." A terse, clipped Roger was all the controller got back. The altitude readout was 330 now. "What's happening?" the supervisor asked.
"He says both engines out. He's dropping rapidly."
A computer screen showed the aircraft to be a Gulfstream, and the flight plan was confirmed.
"It glides well," the supervisor offered optimistically.
310, they both saw. The G4 didn't glide all that well, however.
"Juliet Alpha, Valeta."
Nothing.
"Juliet Alpha, this is Valeta, approach."
"What else is—"
The supervisor checked the screen himself.
No other aircraft in the area, and all one could do was watch anyway. The better to simulate the in-flight emergency, the pilot throttled his engines back to idle. The tendency was to ham things up, but they wouldn't. In fact, they'd say nothing else at all. He pushed the yoke farther forward to increase his rate of descent, then turned to port as though angling towards Malta. That should make the tower people feel good, he thought, passing through 25,000 feet. It actually felt good. He'd been a fighter pilot for his country once, and missed the delightful feelings you got from yanking and banking an airplane around the sky. A descent of this speed would have his passengers white-faced and panicking. For the pilot, it just felt like what flying was supposed to be.
"He must be very heavy," the supervisor said.
"Cleared into Paris de Gaulle."
The controller shrugged and grimaced.
"Just topped off in Benghazi."
"Bad fuel?"
The answer was merely another shrug.
It was like watching death on television, all the more horrible that the alphanumeric blip's altitude digits were clicking down like the symbols on a slot machine. The supervisor lifted a phone.
"Call the Libyans. Ask if they can get a rescue aircraft up. We have an aircraft about to go down in the Gulf of Sidra."
"Valeta, approach. This is USS Radford. Do you copy? Over."
"Radford, Valeta."
"We have your contact on radar. Looks like he's coming down hard."
The voice was that of a junior-grade lieutenant who had the CIC duty this night. Radford was an aging Spruance-class destroyer heading for Naples after an exercise with the Egyptian Navy. Along the way, she had orders to enter the Gulf of Sidra to proclaim freedom of navigation rights, an exercise which was almost as old as the ship herself. Once the source of considerable excitement, and two pitched air-sea battles in the 1980s, it was now boringly routine, else Radford wouldn't be going it alone. Boring enough that the CIC crewmen were monitoring civilian radio freaks to relieve their torpor.
"Contact is 80 miles west of us. We are tracking."
"Can you respond to a rescue request?"
"Valeta, I just woke the captain up. Give us a few to get organized here, but we can make a try for it. Over."
"Dropping like a rock," the petty officer on the main scope reported. "Better pull out soon, fella."
"Target is a Gulf IV business jet. We show him 16,000 and descending rapidly," Valeta advised.
"Thank you. That's about what we have. We are standing by."
"What gives?" the captain asked, dressed in khaki pants and a T-shirt.
The report didn't take long.
"Okay, get the rotor heads woke up."
Next, the commander lifted a growler phone. "Bridge, CIC captain speaking. All ahead full, come right to new course." 275, sir, the radar man advised. "Target is 275 and 83 miles.
New course, 275.
"Aye, sir. Coming right to 275, all ahead full eye," the officer of the deck acknowledged. On the bridge, the quartermaster of the watch pushed down the direct engine control handles, dumping additional fuel into the big GE jet turbines. Radford shuddered a bit, then settled at the stern as she began to accelerate up from 18 knots. The captain looked around the capacious combat information center. The crewmen were alert, a few shaking their heads to come fully awake. The radar men were adjusting their instruments. On the main scope, the display changed, the better to lock in the descending aircraft.
"Let's go to general quarters," the skipper said next. "Might as well get some good training time out of this."
In 30 seconds, everyone aboard was startled into consciousness and running to stations. You have to be careful descending to the ocean surface at night. The pilot of the G-4 kept a close eye on his altitude and rate of descent. The lack of good visual references made it all too easy to slam into the surface, and while that might have made their evening's mission perfect, it wasn't supposed to be that perfect. In another few seconds, they'd drop off the Valletta radar scope, and then they could start pulling out of the dive. The only thing that concerned him now was the possible presence of a ship down there, but no wakes were visible before him in the light of a quarter moon. "I have it," he announced when the aircraft dropped through 5,000 feet. He eased back on the yoke. Valletta might note the change in descent rate from his transponder if they were still getting a signal, but even if they did, they'd assume that after diving to get airflow into his engines, the better to achieve a restart, he was now trying to level out for a controlled landing on the calm sea. "Losing him," the controller said. The display on the screen blinked a few times, came back, then went dark. The supervisor nodded and keyed his microphone. "Radford, this is Valletta. Juliet Alpha has dropped off our screen. Last altitude reading was 6,000 and descending. Course 343. "Valletta, roger, we still have him. Now at 4,500, rate of descent has slowed down some. Course 343, the CIC officer replied. Just 6 feet away from him, the captain was talking with the commander of Radford's air detachment. It would take more than 20 minutes to get the destroyer's single SH-60B Seahawk helicopter launched. The aircraft was now being pre-flighted prior to being pulled out onto the flight deck. The helicopter pilot turned to look at the radar display. "Calm seas. If he has half a brain, somebody might just walk away from this. You try to splash down parallel to the ground swells and ride it out." "Okay, we're on it, sir." With that, he left the CIC and headed aft. "Losing him under the horizon," the radar man reported. "Just passed through 1500. Looks like he's going in." "Tell Valletta," the captain ordered. The G-4 leveled out at 500 feet by the radar altimeter. It was as low as the pilot cared to risk. With that done, he powered the engines back up to cruising power and turned left, south, back toward Libya. He was fully alert now. Flying low was demanding under the best circumstances, and far more so over water at night, but his orders were clear, though their purpose was not. It went rapidly in any case. At just over 300 knots, he had 40 minutes to the military airfield, at which he'd refuel one more time for a flight out of the area. Radford went to flight quarters 5 minutes later, altering course slightly to put the wind over the deck from the proper direction. The Seahawk's tactical navigation system copied the needed data from the ship's CIC. It would search a circle of water 15 miles in diameter in a procedure that would be tedious, time-consuming, and frantic. There were people in the water, and rendering assistance to those in need was the first and oldest law of the sea. As soon as the helicopter lifted off, the destroyer came back left and raced off with all four main engines turning full power.
driving the ship at 34 knots. By this time the captain had radioed his situation to Naples, requesting additional assistance from any nearby fleet units. There were no American ships in the immediate vicinity, but an Italian frigate was heading south for their area, and even the Libyan Air Force asked for information. The lost G-4 landed just as the U.S. Navy helicopter reached the search area. The crew left the aircraft for refreshments while their business jet was fueled. As they watched, a Russian-made AN-10 Cub four-engine transport fired up its engines to participate in the search and rescue mission. The Libyans were cooperating now with such things, trying to rejoin the world community. And even their commanders didn't know very much, indeed hardly anything at all, of what had gone on. Just a few phone calls had made the arrangements, and whoever had taken the call and cooperated knew only that two aircraft would be landing to fuel and move on. An hour later, they lifted off again for the 3-hour flight to Damascus, Syria. It had been originally thought that they would fly right back to their home base in Switzerland, but the pilot had pointed out that two aircraft of the same ownership flying over the same spot at nearly the same time would cause questions. He turned the aircraft east during the climb-out. Below to his left in the Gulf of Sidra, they saw the flashing lights of aircraft, one of them a helicopter, they were surprised to note. People were burning fuel and spending time, and all for nothing. That thought amused the pilot as he reached his cruising altitude and relaxed, letting the autopilot do the work for the remainder of a long day's flying.
"Are we there yet?"
Moody turned his head. He just changed the IV bottle for their patient. Inside his plastic helmet, his face itched from his growing beard. He saw that Sister Maria Magdalena had the same crawly, unwashed feeling he had. Her first action on waking was to move her hands to her face, stopped short by the clear plastic.
"No, sister, but soon. Please rest yourself. I can do this."
"No, no, you must be very tired, Dr. Moody."
She started to rise.
"I am younger and better rested," the physician replied with a raised hand.
Next he replaced the morphine bottle with a fresh one. Jean-Baptiste was thankfully still too heavily drugged to be a problem.
"What time is it?"
"Time for you to rest. You will attend your friend when we arrive, but then other doctors will be able to relieve me. Please conserve your strength. You will need it."
Which was true enough. The nun didn't reply. Accustomed to following the orders of doctors, she turned her head, probably whispered a prayer, and allowed her eyes to close. When he was sure that she was back asleep, he moved forward.
"How much longer?"
40 minutes. We'll land a little early. The winds have been good to us," the co-pilot answered.
"So, before dawn?"
"Yes."
"What is her problem?" the pilot asked, not turning,
but sufficiently bored that he wanted to hear something new.
"You do not wish to know," Moody assured him.
"She will die, this woman?"
"Yes, and the aircraft must be completely disinfected before it is used again."
"That's what they told us." The pilot shrugged, not knowing how frightened he should be of what he was carrying. Moody did. The plastic sheet under his patient would now contain a pool of infected blood. They'd have to be extremely careful unloading her. Badrine was grateful that he'd avoided alcohol. He was the most conscious man in the room. 10 hours, he thought, looking at his watch. 10 hours they'd talked and disputed like a bunch of old women in a market.
"He will agree to this?" the guard's commander asked.
"It is not unreasonable in the least," Ali replied.
5 senior mullahs would fly to Baghdad, offering themselves as hostage to, if not the goodwill, then the good word of their leader. It actually worked out better than the assembled generals knew, not that they really cared. With that settled, the general officers looked at one another, and one by one they nodded.
"We accept," the same general said, speaking for the group.
that hundreds of lesser officers would be left behind to face whatever music was in store for them was, after all, a small thing. The lengthy discussion hadn't touched on that subject very much.
"I require a telephone," Badrine told them next.
The intelligence chief led him to a side room. There had always been a direct line to Tehran. Even during hostilities, there had been a communications link, that one via microwave tower. The next one was a fiber-optic cable whose transmissions could not be intercepted. Under the watchful eyes of the Iraqi officer, he punched the numbers he'd memorized several days earlier.
"This is Yusif. I have news," he told the voice which answered.
"Please wait," was the reply.
Daryai didn't enjoy being awakened early any more than a normal person, the less so that he'd slept poorly over the last few days. When his bedside phone rang, he blinked his eyes for several rings before reaching to lift it.
"Yes?"
"This is Yusif. It is agreed. 5 friends are required."
"All praise to Allah, for he is beneficent," Daryai thought to himself. All the years of war and peace had come to fruition in this moment. No, that was premature. There was much yet to be done. But the most difficult thing was done now.
"When shall we begin?"
"As quickly as possible."
"Thank you. I will not forget."
With that he came fully awake. This morning, the first in many years, he forgot his morning prayers. God would understand that his work must be done quickly.
How weary she must have been, Moody thought. Both nuns started to wakefulness when the aircraft touched down.
There came the usual jolting as the aircraft slowed, and a watery sound announced the fact that Jean-Baptiste had indeed bled out as he'd expected. So he'd gotten her here alive, at least. Her eyes were open, though confused as an infant's, as she stared at the curving ceiling of the cabin. Maria Magdalena took a moment to look out the windows, but all she saw was an airport, and those appeared the same all over the world, particularly at night. In due course the aircraft stopped, and the door dropped open. Again they would travel in a truck. 4 people came into the aircraft, all of them dressed in protective plastic. Maudi loosened the straps on his patient, waving the other nun to stay in place. Carefully, the 4 army medics lifted the sturdy plastic sheet by the corners and moved towards the door. As they did so, Maudi saw something drip onto the flat-folded seat that had served their patient as a bed. He shook it off. The flight crew had their orders, and the orders had been repeated often enough. When the patient was safely on the truck, Maudi and Maria Magdalena walked down the steps as well. Both removed their headgear, allowing themselves to breathe fresh, cool air. He took a canteen from one of the armed party around the aircraft and offered it to her, as he fetched another for himself. Both drained a full liter of water before entering the truck. Both were disoriented by the long flight, she the more so for not knowing where she really was. Maudi saw the 707, which had arrived shortly before with the monkeys, though he didn't know that was the cargo.
"I've never seen Paris. Well, except flying through all these years," she said, looking around before the back flap was dropped, cutting off the view.
"A pity you never will."
Chapter 16. The Iraqi Transfer. A whole lot of nothing here, the pilot observed. The Seahawk was circling at 1,000 feet, scanning the surface with a search radar acute enough to detect wreckage. It was designed to spot a submarine's periscope, but finding not so much as a floating bottle of Perrier. Both also wore low-light goggles, and they should have turned up a slick of jet fuel from the oily shine. But that also was negative.
"Must have hit pretty hard not to leave anything," the co-pilot replied over the intercom. "Unless we're looking in the wrong spot."
The pilot looked down at his tactical navigation system. They were in the right place. They were down to an hour's fuel. Time to start thinking about landing back on Radford, which was now combing the search area herself.
The searchlights looked theatrical in the pre-dawn darkness, like something out of a World War II movie. A Libyan cub was circling around, too, trying to be helpful, but mainly being a pain in the ass.
"Anything at all?" the controller on Radford asked.
"Negative. Nothing. Say again, nothing down there that we can see. 1 hour's worth of gas here, over."
"Copy, 1 hour gas," Radford acknowledged.
"Sir, the target's last course was 343. Speed 290 knots. Rate of descent 3,000 foot per minute.
If he ain't in this footprint, I don't know why," a chief operations specialist said, tapping the chart.
The captain sipped at his coffee and shrugged. Topside, the fire and rescue party was standing by. Two swimmers were in wetsuits, with a boat crew standing by the launch. There was a lookout posted for every set of binoculars aboard, looking for strobe lights or anything else, and sonar was listening for the high-frequency ping of the aircraft's emergency locator. Those instruments were designed to survive a severe impact, were automatically activated when exposed to seawater, and had battery power to operate for several days. Radford's sonar was sensitive enough to detect the damned thing from 30 miles away, and they were right over the impact zone predicted by the radar crew. Neither the ship nor her crew had ever done a rescue like this, but it was something for which they regularly drilled, and every procedure had been executed as perfectly as the CO could wish.
"USS Radford, USS Radford, this is Valeta Approach, over."
The captain lifted the microphone.
"Valeta, this is Radford. Have you located anything? Over."
"Negative, Valeta. Our helo's been all over the area, nothing to report yet."
They'd already queried Malta for corrected data on the aircraft's last speed and heading, but it had dropped off the civilian radar even before departing the destroyer's more precise coverage. On both ends of the radio link, men sighed. They all knew how this would play out now. The search would continue for a day, no more, no less, and nothing would be found, and that was that. A telex had already gone to the manufacturer, informing them that one of their aircraft was lost at sea. Gulfstream representatives would fly to Bern to go over maintenance records and other printed data on the aircraft, hoping to garner a clue, and probably finding nothing, and this whole case would go into the unknown column in somebody's ledger book. But the game had to be played out, and hell, it was still good training time for the crew of USS Radford. The crew would shrug it off. It wasn't anyone they knew, however desirable and uplifting a successful rescue would have been. It was probably the smell that told her what was wrong. The drive from the airport had been brief. It was dark outside still, and when the truck stopped, both doctor and nurse were still suffering from the lengthy time in movement. They arrived, and the first business was to get Sister Jean-Baptiste inside. Only then did both of them remove their plastic garb for the last time. Maria Magdalena smoothed her short hair and breathed heavily, finally taking the time to look around, then was surprised at what she saw. Mahudi saw the confusion and led her inside before she could comment on it. That was when the smell hit them. A familiar African smell from the entry of the monkeys a few hours earlier. Decidedly not something one would associate with Paris, or a place as clean and orderly as the Pasteur Institute had to be. Next, Maria Magdalena looked around and realized that the signs on the walls were not in French. There was no way she could know what the situation was. There were merely grounds for confusion, to be followed by questions. And then, just as well, it was time, before the questions could be asked. A soldier appeared and took her arm and led her away, too uncomprehending still to say anything. She merely looked over her shoulder at an unshaven man in surgical greens, a sad look on his face giving greater substance to her confusion.
"What is this? Who is she?" the director of the project asked.
"It is a rule of their religion that they cannot travel alone, to protect their chastity," Mahudi explained. "Otherwise I could not have come here with our patient."
"She is still alive?"
He hadn't been there for the arrival.
Mahoudi nodded. Yes, we should be able to keep her going another 3 days, maybe 4, he thought.
And the other?
Mahoudi dodged.
That is not for me to say.
We could always have another...
No, that would be barbaric, Mahoudi protested. Such things are hateful to God.
And what we plan to do is not? The director asked.
Clearly Mahoudi had been in the bush for too long. But it wasn't worth fighting over. One fully infected Ebola patient was all they needed.
Get cleaned up and we will go up to see her.
Mahoudi headed off to the doctor's lounge on the second floor. The facility was actually more private than its Western counterparts, as people in this part of the world had higher standards of body modesty. The plastic suit he saw with some surprise had survived the trip without a single tear. He dumped it in a large plastic bin before heading into a shower, whose hot water was supplemented with chemicals. He hardly noticed the smell anymore. And there he enjoyed 5 minutes of sanitary bliss. On the flight, he'd wondered if he would ever be clean again. In the shower now, his mind asked a similar question, but more quietly. He emerged to don fresh greens, fresh everything, in fact, and to complete his normally fastidious routine. A medical orderly had placed a brand new suit in the lounge for him, this one a blue American Recal fresh out of its box, which he put on before heading out into the corridor. The director, similarly dressed, was waiting for him, and together they walked down toward the suite of treatment rooms. There were only 4 of them behind sealed, guarded doors. The Iranian army ran this facility. The doctors were military physicians, and the orderlies all men with battlefield experience. Security was tight, as one would expect. Mahoudi and the director had cleared security on the first floor, however, and the guard at the post touched the buttons to open the doors into the airlock. These opened with a hiss of hydraulics to reveal a second set, and they could see that smoke from the soldier's cigarette was sucked into the secure area. Good. The air system was working properly. Both men had a strange prejudice against their own countrymen. It would have been preferable for this entire facility to have been built by foreign engineers. Germans were popular in the Middle East for such things, but Iraq had made that mistake to its sorrow. The orderly Germans kept plans of everything they built, as a result of which so many of their projects had been bombed to dust. And so, while a lot of the building's hardware had been bought elsewhere, the facility had been constructed locally. Their very lives depended on the exact performance of every subsystem here, but that could not be helped now. The inner doors would not open unless the outer ones were locked tight. That worked. The director activated them, and they proceeded. Sister Jean-Baptiste was in the last room on the right. 3 medical orderlies were in with her. They'd already cut off all her clothing, revealing a death in progress. The soldiers were repulsed by what they saw, her condition more terrible than any battlefield injury. Quickly they cleaned off her body, then covered it, respectful of the woman's modesty, as their culture insisted. The director looked at the morphine drip and immediately turned it back by a third.
"We want to keep her alive as long as possible," he explained.
"The pain from this cannot be helped," he responded coldly. He thought to reproach Mahoudi, but stopped himself. He was a physician, too, and knew that it was hard to regard one's patient with harshness. Elderly Caucasian female, he saw, stuporous from the morphine, respiration too slow for his liking. The orderlies attached leads for the electrocardiograph, and he was surprised at how well her heart was working.
Good.
Blood pressure was low, as expected, and he ordered 2 units of whole blood to be hung on the IV tree. The more blood, the better. The orderlies were well drilled. Everything that had come in with the patient had already been bagged, then double-bagged. One of their number carried the bundle out of the room and off to the gas-fired incinerator, which would leave behind nothing but sterilized ashes. The main issue here was management of the virus.
The patient was their culture dish. Previously, such victims had had a few cc's of blood drawn.